You know what was on the jukebox in the front. Now Matt the Cat's gonna show you what was on the juke in the back.
Baby, I'm Matt the Cat, where it's at? Back at Rosie's Shack with stacks of shellac, playing the platters that matter and making them splatter like pancake batter. Welcome to another edition of The Juke in the Back, 1940s and 50s rhythm and blues. This is the soul that came before rock and roll. And this week we're featuring one of the most successful New York vocal groups from the 1950s, and one of the few groups that actually reinvented themselves in the early 60s. From Jamaica, Queens, it's the Cleftones. We unfortunately lost one of the Cleftones' primary singers and songwriters, Herbie Cox. He died on December 7th, 2019 at the age of 80. He had been suffering from Alzheimer's disease for quite a while. Herbie was a great guy, but cats and kittens, we are so lucky that we have a great Herb Cox interview that I conducted about 15 years ago, where he tells the complete Cleftone story in his own words. So I'm going to do my best on this particular episode of The Juke in the Back to keep my yammering to a minimum. Let's let the late, great Herbie Cox tell the story of the Cleftones on this week's Juke in the Back.
I guess we should probably start at the beginning.
Sure.
You guys got together in Jamaica, Queens.
That's right? Correct. That's correct.
And in high school.
Yes, we were all students at Jamaica High School in Queens.
Right. And how did you get together with the other guys? Like, how did the band actually, how did the group, how did you guys start singing together, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, okay, it sounds like one of these Mickey Rooney B-movies, okay? But this is true. We were all in high school together, and we had been singing a little bit prior to that, not very successfully, and just with various groups of people, at least I had. But when we got to high school, remember what's called the general organization? This used to be a big thing in high school, GO, and that's basically the student government, where the student body would have a president of the student body, secretary, etc. And most people thought that was pretty dull and, you know, not very exciting because we're all trying to be involved in sports. But I would always volunteer for the GO organization because you'd get out of class by doing volunteer work like painting signs and doing stuff like that. And that's what I was doing along with Warren Corbin and another guy, Buzzy McLean, and then later Charlie James. We were all involved in that way. And we used to sing out on the handball court at school just extemporaneously getting together. And some of the kids would hear us and like to stand around and listen. And at one of those high school election campaigns, somebody said, "Hey, wouldn't it be great if you guys could create a slogan for the party, one of the two parties that was running?" In those days, they were called the Red and Blue Party, which was the party where all of the sports jocks and the popular kids were, and the other party was called the Independent Party, pretty much the nerds and the squares, you know. And we were asked by the nerds and the squares to create a jingle for them, and I guess they thought, hey, they better try something. They hadn't won an election in that school in years, so we didn't care, frankly. We didn't care which side, just so we were getting out of class, man. So what we did was actually a stroke of genius without knowing. We took a song that we liked by the group The Crows called G, mm-hmm. which happened to be just, this was very much of a coincidence with what was to follow later, and we took that song G and we turned it into an election campaign song. You know, G, vote for IND, my oh me, vote for IND, we've got what it takes to put you in the groove. So vote for Independent, and we'll really, really, really move. My, oh, gee. So, you know, we took it. We sort of changed the lyrics around. And that was the extent of our creative ability. But little did we know how important that was, because the school had taken a stand to ban, quote-unquote, rock and roll from the school. Mm. It was a rather conservative school at that time. And but they encouraged all the kids to take part in the GO organization. It was the faculty basically managed the event. So when we sang this jingle in the school auditorium, the kids went wild. Now the faculty looked at one another and said, "Wait a minute, isn't that rock and roll they're singing?" But the lyrics were perfectly right for a campaign song for this election. And the kids got the inside on it right away. They thought we were really slick and in a subversive way getting rock and roll into the school. And
wow.
And it's a hard to believe story, but the Independent Party won that year for the first time, I think, in 8 straight school elections, and we were sort of like folk heroes. And after that, we became like the darlings of the school.
Wow.
And that's how we first really actually began.
And the other coincidence is
yes.
that you were singing G and you ended up on G Records.
Exactly. Is that hard to believe?
Yeah.
And you know, we went to many record companies before we were selected at G, too. So.
Yeah. Goldner's labels.
Yes, indeed it was. And well, when we went over to we were auditioning, the extension of that story about the election, that there was a kid, his name was David Rolnick, a Jewish kid who always wanted to hang out with the brothers, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and
sure.
sing some songs, but he was an awful singer. he was terrible. And we said, no, Dave, don't sing, please. Don't come in. You're messing up the harmony, man. Lay out, Dave.
Yeah.
You know, you're one of the guys, but don't sing. So he said, well, look, if I can't sing, why don't you let me be the manager of the group? We said, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, nothing from nothing leaves nothing, you know.
Right.
So he became our manager. And little did we know how effective David Rolnick would be. First of all, he started getting us shows at the local Jewish center that used to have dances, on weekends. And we would go over there and we'd sing 2 or 3 of our songs by groups like the Moon Glows, or we loved Lillian Leach and the Mellow.
Oh, I met her not too long ago.
Cigarette and stuff
yeah,
like that.
She's great.
And the Solitaires and of course 5 Keys. Those were our favorites in the harp tones.
Mm-hmm.
But But he also, you know, took our popularity and what he thought was our potential and took it seriously. And he went into Manhattan, and he got us an audition. About once a week, we'd get ready, we'd rehearse, and he'd, you know, get us on the subway, and we'd go from Queens into Manhattan, which was a big deal for us, and we'd audition. We auditioned for Apollo Records, and they said, well, thanks, but come back a little later after the guys get a little bit more developed. We went to Old Town Records, and they really weren't too impressed with us. And we went over to George Goldner at what we in those days thought of as Rama and Tico Records.
Right.
There was no such thing as G then. And we went over and we auditioned for him. It's a great story how we met him, but we auditioned for him. And he said, okay, come in next Tuesday. I'm going to record you guys. And, I mean, we went ballistic, you know, at that. And Dave Rolnick was instrumental in doing that. He went on to have a very good career in the music industry, in the distributing and marketing portion of the music industry. After we had some success, our first record, we were fortunate enough that our first release, You Baby You, was a hit record.
Right.
And George Goldner listened to our original stuff, and he heard You Baby You, and we had Little Girl of Mine at that time, too. He said, I really like that song, but I want you guys to work on that just a little bit more. And so he went with You Baby You and a ballad called I Was Dreaming. And that was our first release, and we sat around, listened. First time we heard ourselves on the radio, I didn't even hear the song after Alan Freed says, now here they are, a new group from Queens, the Cleftones. And we screamed the rest of the way. I didn't hear any part of it. We all gathered around a radio at a friend's house, a young lady's house, and we just hollered, and, you know, and that was it. To me, that was the career. We got on the Alan Freed Show. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, little girl of mine, do you sure look fine? Yes, you appeal to me. I never set you free. Be my loving baby to the end of time. I can't sleep, get you off my mind.
Yeah.
The boys all roll their eyes as we go strolling by. My baby.
The Cleftones with Jimmy Wright and his orchestra, and their first of two hits, Little Girl of Mine, which was recorded in February of 56 and went to number 8 on the National Rhythm and Blues lists in May of 56. It crossed over to a whopping number 57 on the pop charts, which doesn't sound like a high number, but hitting 57 on the pop charts when you're an African-American vocal group in 1956 was pretty solid indeed. I have always loved the sax break in Little Girl of Mine, performed by Jimmy Wright. And in the first record we heard, which was the Cleftones' first release, You Baby You, recorded at their first session held in November of 55, jazz great Kenny Burrell is sitting in on guitar on that record, and you'll hear the guitar just jump all around that song. It sounds fantastic. Burrell was just moonlighting as a session guy. We're featuring the Cleftones on this week's Juke in the Back with the late great Herbie Cox. Now let's flip Little Girl of Mine over and dig on You're Driving Me Mad. I'm Matt the Cat, dropping another nickel into the old Juke in the Back. Generous support for Juke in the Back provided by weekly sustainers Janice Stenhouse, Robert Stallworth, Barry from San Diego, Mr. Lee, David Ayers, Thomas Huber, Joe Metzger, Bernie Rossman, Barry from Riverside, and contributors Charles Liebman, Mark and Marion McAlpine, Ken Farger, Gail Kuntz, Michael Carey, Dante DeWitt. Thank you for your support. More information at jukeintheback.org.
You're listening to The Juke in the Back with Matt the Cat. Bow, 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 bow. Bow, 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 bow. Bow, 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 bow.
Recorded in May of 1956 and issued in June, the third single for the Cleftones, Can't We Be Sweethearts, featuring Berman Patterson doing the whoa-ohs at the beginning and Herb Cox handling the lead vocals. We're celebrating the music of the Cleftones with the late, great Herbie Cox this week on the Juke in the Back. I was fortunate enough to interview him a while ago, and it's great to be able to play this back and have Herb Cox tell the Cleftones story in his own words. Right now, we're going to listen in as Herbie talks about the business, the music business, in 1956.
There's a local record shop in Jamaica at that time called Triborough Records. Mm-hmm. And they had a poster in there. Well, like on a Saturday, you know, when we weren't in school, I'd go to the record shop six times just to see our picture. I must have bought five or six of our records myself, and I'd take various members of my family up there. But it did become a hit, and they used to play it, you know, through the speakers outside in the crowd. Boy, that was just great. That was, the innocence of youth and without thinking much of a long-term career. But, of course, after we had a record that made the charts, we were in the business then, whether we wanted to be or not.
Right.
And new management stepped in then and took over from Dave, mm-hmm. Rather involuntary from his point of view.
Right.
That's the way business was in those days. And we were with an organization that had, shall we say, a lot of influence from other sections of society, you know.
Well, I was going to ask about that. So, Morris Levy. Did you ever meet him?
Oh, did I ever? Sure. I knew Morris well. And when I say knew him well,
not too well.
Not too well. No, that was not always advisable. But Morris liked the Cleftones. He looked upon us, I guess, sort of as like a lucky mascot or something. Mm. He certainly didn't. He wasn't in the business. You know, we didn't get him in the business. He'd been, been known for a lot of things before we came along. But I think we were the beginning of a lot of success he had with G and ultimately Roulette Records,
right.
And with George was. I always thought George was the boss. But then I later learned, of course, that Morris was, in fact, the power behind the power.
Right.
And what he said counted. As a matter of fact, we came into George's office one day expecting to talk about making another record. And Morris is sitting, or we called him Mo, he was sitting behind George's desk. And George is off on the side. And two or three other guys were with Mo. And he says, "How you doing, guys? I'm Mo Levy." He says, "I want to introduce you to your new manager." And we said, well, wait a minute, we got a manager, Dave, who was with us. He says, no, don't worry about Dave. We'll talk to Dave. And Dave was not afraid to speak out, and he was young enough and inexperienced enough not to know who he was talking to. And he said, "Well, who the hell are you guys, And he said, "Well, no, let's not get off on the wrong foot, kid." A couple of sort of big guys said, "Look, come on, let's talk. Let's go outside, Dave." They took him out in the hallway. And, Morris is telling us, "Look, you guys have a good opportunity. We'll take good care of you. You won't have any problems in the business. You're going to be on all Alan Freed shows, And, we were loyal to Dave.
Mm-hmm.
But when he came back in, he said, "Look, fellas, don't worry. It's going to be okay. Let's just go along with it. I'm going to be okay. Don't worry. I'll still be helping you out." But they had obviously had a stern talking with him.
Yeah.
And so that was the last of Dave Rolnick being our mm-hmm. manager. He did work with us effectively. He ended up working with the record company for a while, and then later went on to many other things. You've probably seen his name on the back of liner notes and other things.
Yeah.
He had produced some records, and he had a quite successful career in marketing in the business.
Did names of people you didn't know start showing up as writers on your songs?
Yes, unfortunately, and worse yet, it was people that we knew. So we, you know, that was the way we'd come in. And you know, I remember Berman was the writer of You Baby You, and I remember we were in the session, and George Goldner came in and says, "Okay, we're the writer on this, right?" And before Berman could say yes or no, but frankly, we didn't know much better,
mm-hmm.
and it was wrong, but we didn't feel coerced at the time because we didn't know the value of publishing and our writers' rights, if you will. We really didn't know, and so we were taken advantage of like many others. We fared a little bit better for one simple reason. I skipped over the part where we auditioned for George Goldner, but when we did audition for him, he gave us a contract to take home because we were all underage. And he says, "Look, get your parents to sign this and be back in here Tuesday and we're going to record," or words to that effect. So I know when I took it home, my mother said, "I'm not signing this. I don't know what this is. I can't, you know." She says, "You have to have a lawyer." So I said, "But Mom, don't." She says, "Well, you're not going to sign this." And she began to take a pencil, and I said, "Oh, no, Mr. Goldner said, don't mess up the contract, you know." And not only did my mom take offense, but I remember specifically Berman Patterson's parents did too, and they were unhappy with this. The net is when we went back to George with the marked up contract, he threw us out. He says, "Oh, get the hell out of my office. So, you know, who do you guys think you are? You take my contract and do this." But when I came back home, I know personally I was just crestfallen. I said, "Mom, you know, see, this messed up the whole thing. We're not going to make a record now." And she said something to me that I think was the beginning of my education in understanding the business side of show business. She says, "If you're really good, they'll call you back." And they did. They called us back, and they made some adjustments. We still signed what by today would be a very poor contract, but not nearly as bad as what it might have been. Thus, okay. We always got 50% of our writers' royalties, etc. I know many acts who got nothing.
Be-bom, dooby-dooby-bom, bom, be-bom.
Boop, dooby-dooby-dooby-doo. Boop, dooby-dooby-dooby-doo. Boop, dooby-dooby-dooby-doo. Whoa, wop.
Be-bom. Don't you know I'm in love with you? Boop, can't see what I'm saying is true. Boop, I've loved you right from the start. Boop, oh, baby, we'll never part. You're my valentine. Oh yes, you're my one and all. Oh yes, you're my baby doll. And you've got a string around my heart. Nobody else could be not half as sweet to me as you, my love. How lucky can one be, for heaven sent to me an angel from. Don't you know I'm in love with you? Can't see what I'm saying is true. I've loved you right from the start. Oh, baby, we'll never part. Cause you got a string around my heart. You're my valentine. Oh yes, you're my baby doll.
Jim.
Oh yes, you're my one and all. And you got a string around my heart. Yes, you got a string around my heart. Yes, you got a string around my heart. And you got a string around my heart.
Did you get a couple of pennies per record?
Oh yeah, it was 2 cents a record.
Split between five guys?
Yeah, between five guys. And not only that, I mean, it was a handwritten a statement that we'd get. And no matter what, I don't care if we were number 8 in the R&B charts, number 55 on the pop charts, and we'd pick up Cashbox and Billboard and say, ship 2 million in 2 weeks. No matter what, we got a statement that basically said we sold 460-something records.
It was
bad news all the way. We were obviously ripped off.
Yeah.
But we didn't know much better, and we were kids. And then quickly, they kept our attention away from the statements, but rather they put us out on tour
right
away, and that was another world, complete other world for us. It was a really shock, and because we weren't ready to perform on the road, frankly. The performing
nice segue.
For high school kids is one thing, but
right. Being
at the Fox Theater in Detroit, you know, opening up a show with big stars like Laverne Baker and a very smooth and polished group of Cadillacs at the time, that's a different story. And we had our tough times. We certainly did. But our guys always had a lot of pride. And I remember one time, I know I had tears in my eyes after one performance. I thought we were just, like, embarrassingly bad. And there was so much we didn't know.
Yeah.
And we went back to sort of really to get serious about it ourselves. This is one of the unfortunate things that happened that was bad but turned out to be good for us, Matt. And that is, no sooner had we got out of the box with Little Girl, You Baby You, and Little Girl of Mine was on the rise, along comes the Teenagers, who basically became the number one act on the label. Frankie Lyman was just tremendous, and these were kids, maybe we were a year older than them, but not much. But Frankie was 2 or 3 years younger than we were. Mm-hmm. So he was absolutely a star. You could hear it the minute we were in the office when he auditioned. Richard Barrett from the Valentines brought him in to audition, and we heard them right there. And so what could have made us bitter rivals and enemies never happened, and it really made us a better group. They got the spotlight. We had to go the long way. We had to learn our craft, and we did. We went back, we studied, we worked with Charlie Atkins, who later taught the Temptations. We went to Charlie because we knew the Cadillacs had gone to Charlie Atkins. And we went, and we learned, and we took I never take anything away from the Teenagers because they were like a shooting star, but we had a much longer career.
Right, and you guys, I mean, overall, I've always thought of the Cleftones as having a unique sound for the New York doo-wop sound.
Yeah.
Because even though, you know, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers were a trailblazing band for or group for the, like the little kid lead sound. I mean, they were the first ones, but there were so many imitators that came after him.
Yes, this is true. The schoolboys, the students,
the students, the youngsters, like you could really group a bunch of them together.
Yes.
Whereas you guys didn't sound like the Cadillacs. You guys didn't sound like the Paragons. You didn't sound like the Jesters. You didn't sound like these other New York groups. The Cleftones really sounded different.
Yeah, we often talk about that. I don't know. We were an unusual mix that worked. I was from Cincinnati, Ohio, from a gospel background through my grandmother who sang and used to put me in the church choir. Charlie was from Alabama, and Charlie knew a lot about blues and stuff like that. Charlie was a great harmony guy, tremendous ear. Charlie James, I'm talking about, one of the original founding members of the group.
Right.
Berman was very much of a pop type of singer. You know, I mean, his idols were, people like Frank Sinatra and, you know, stuff like that. He liked that. He brought that element to it. And Warren and I used to sing. Warren liked the Vaughn Monroe songs. We used to sing, you know, like High Noon and Riders in the Sky and stuff like that. And Buzzy was a streetwise New Yorker. who was really the leader of the group when we first formed, Buzzy McLean, our baritone. So, but somehow we came together and we found some common ground, and we always felt like we had a different sound. We didn't always know whether it was good or not, but we knew we sounded different.
It's time for the Great 78, where we take a thick piece of shellac and harken back to a time when 78 RPM records were king. This week we're featuring the Cleftones. So let's hear the flip side of their third single, Can't We Be Sweethearts, Neki Hokey. It was recorded at their third recording session, held in May of 1956. The record was issued in June and features Berman Patterson handling the lead vocals. And it's this week's Great 78, The Cleftones with Neki Hokey.
Neki Hokey, Dokey, Louie, I love you, baby, can't you see? Oh, chubby, dubby, dubby, lovey, dove, that I want to give you all my love. Everything is gonna be okay. Tooby dooby dooby doobie. I want you, baby, can't you see? Of chubby dubby dubby lovey dove. But I want to give you all my love. Neki okie doke, I'll be glad when you say, in your kind of baby loving way. Neki hokey, say you love me, don't be mopey, slopey mopey. Neki hokey, say you want me, don't be dopey. Okay, I hope someday, maybe you say in your Neki Hokey loving way.
Yeah.
Ooh, 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 oo
You're listening to The Juke in the Back with Matt the Cat.
Do you remember any stories from the first package tour when you guys went on tour for one of those package tours?
Oh, yeah. Well, the first set of tours we went on were Irving Fells, and they were called the Cavalcade of Stars of 56, etc. Two things I remember right off the bat there. Number one, as I say, we were very experienced. And now I say this with great respect to the person I'm going to mention because, she's proven herself a million times over, great lady. But we used to come on immediately. We were the second or the third act on the bill. It's a great show. Carl Perkins, Kathy Carr, the Spaniels, the Platters, and the Teenagers, the Cleftones, and I'm forgetting someone, but that was essentially the tour. And we traveled in buses all over, and into the South, and we experienced discrimination and segregation for the first time, and that was eye opening.
I bet.
But what always reminds me, what I always think of in that tour, was every day, every night, no matter whether we were in Tulsa or Memphis or in Alabama or in wherever, Chicago, Della Reese had a hit song out. It was on the charts. It was a ballad. And she would open, and it was a decidedly pop ballad.
And that reminds me? Was that the one?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I believe that is the one. I hear the sound of music. And she sang beautifully. She was just a smooth, professional, gorgeous young woman at that time. But she'd come on, and these people were there to see rock and roll because this Irving Feld show was one of the first big nationwide packages out. Not the first, but one of the first big ones of that nature that was. We did 45 towns in 49 nights all over the country. And every night she'd come out, and the audience would boo her when she got into her song. That was not what they came to see. They came to see rock and roll. And she had to fight through that every night. And we had to stand in the wings and watch her because we followed her on. So it was always great for us because we were more of what they had been looking for, But I was always, I didn't know how she could do that every night. I saw her cry many nights. And I recognized that, we used to try to talk to her. And now she was a little bit older than us and certainly much more experienced in the business and she said, well, this is the way the business is. Sometimes you just have to go through that, But that's one of the, thoughts that stick to me.
Winter's about over. Spring will soon be here. I'll be looking forward to seeing you next year.
I'll carry your books from.
Oh, how I
The Cleftones, this week's feature on the Juke in the Back with See You Next Year, a song recorded in April of 1957 and released in June, just in time for summer vacation. Herbie Cox and Berman Patterson are exchanging lead vocals on that one. Time is running short on the Juke in the Back, so I want to get back to the Herb Cox interview I conducted years ago. And this next segment is very important as Herbie Cox talks about the segregation that the Cleftones experienced on their first couple of tours of the Southern United States. A moment ago, he gave us his first impressions of touring, which was the hardships encountered by Della Reese. And now he gives us his second impression.
The other was discovering America really for the first time. And you don't see a lot. Sometimes you saw a Holiday Inn where we stayed in the arena. You know, you don't see much. But we met so many different kinds of people and had so many different kinds of experiences that it made us grow up very quickly, I think. And by the time we were ready to go out on Fell's next show, The Cavalcade of Stars, I believe it was in 57, we also went on. We were a lot more mature, and we had begun to develop some attitudes about social conditions, etc. And there was a lot of, let's say, angst and disagreement on the tour bus. We used to go in the South. They'd ask the black acts to sit in the back.
Mm.
And I'll tell you something that I learned there, too. Mm. This may have happened on the first tour, not the second. It was the first, because Bobby Charles, who wrote and originated See You Later, Alligator, was on that show.
Right.
And he's a young man like we were, except I think Bobby's from New Orleans originally, or someplace in Louisiana originally.
Mm-hmm. And so he's used to it.
Yeah, he used to hang out in the back of the bus with us as a white kid. He'd play cards, and he was just a lot of fun. We'd sing. And I remember a trooper got on the bus one time to inspect the bus because it was always some discussion, that's right, Kathy Carr was on the show, who was a very beautiful young white lady, had a big hit with Ivory Tower out at that time. And there was always some issue about, you know, what was she doing on the bus with mainly a lot of black people. Now, Carl Perkins was on this tour, too. And
yeah.
Carl just sort of stayed cool, you know. But Bobby Charles, to everyone's shock and amazement, this trooper got on and he said, "Well, what are you doing back there in the back of the bus? You come up," and he says, "Oh, listen, man, I can sit where I want to sit. Who do you think you are?" And we were saying, "Oh, Bobby, don't." But he told the trooper off. He said, "I don't know what's wrong with you, but we're all together and we're musicians. We're not hurting anybody, and we just want to do our music, you know." And he, as a kid, he stood up to that, and I was truly impressed with him. And, you know, maybe it was, you know, being young and foolish, but he stood up for his principal, and stood up for everyone on the bus. Frankly, everyone else was afraid, including me. I didn't dare say anything,
right.
You know, but you know, those things make you grow up fast.
Yeah,
and the second tour we went on, faced with the same thing, Buzzy, who I told you was a streetwise kid, he said, "I'm not going to do this anymore." He said, "I'm not going to do it. I don't have to do it. You know, my family has their own business. You know, I have my own automobile at home. I don't have to put up with this crap." And he didn't. He quit soon after that.
He quit the group.
He left the group. And it was primarily over tensions like that on the road. He didn't like this. He didn't like the fact that we had to stay in segregated hotels.
Yeah.
I remember being in Oklahoma City. We had just done a good show for us, and you know, people had received us very warmly. The next day, we went out to see Oklahoma City. We're walking in downtown. Charlie James, Buzzy, and myself, and very hot. You know, must have been 90 something degrees. And we stopped, and it wasn't a Woolworth or a 5 and 10, but it was that type of place. It had a lunch counter. And we went in because I saw this orange juice thing going around. And I said, "Boy, could I use a drink of orange juice?" And when we came in, the young lady behind the counter said, "Oh, aren't you the guys who were singing last night at the arena?" And we said, "Yeah." She said, "Oh, you were great. I enjoyed it. I told all my friends." And, you know, it's all terrific. You know, it's a nice, warm welcome. So she said, well, how can I help you guys? I said, well, could I have some of that orange juice? She said, oh, sure, hang on. So she went behind and she's looking. She said, I'm sorry, I don't have any more cups. I said, well, I don't need a cup. You could put it in a glass. She said, oh, no, we can't serve colored here. I was like, what?
Wait, she was going to give you a cup to take it with you?
To take out,
but
yes.
You couldn't sit there and drink it?
No, I couldn't.
Oh.
So Buzzy was disgusted. I was hurt and disgusted, and so was Charlie. But that's the type of thing that we had to live with early on.
Ugh.
And so by the second tour, we had all sort of said, and with Buzzy choosing to leave, it wasn't strictly over that issue.
Yeah.
I mean, there were other things. He didn't like to be away from home so long, and, you know, and he had other opportunities in life.
Mm-hmm.
And but I always respected his stand, and it certainly would have been easier if we hadn't encountered those things. But he left the group really in 58, but that tour in 57, he said, no, I'm not going to do another one of these things down here.
Right.
I'm not doing it. So that was tough. So you grow up fast.
Wow, that gets me every time. Over the years, I've always made it a point during any of these interviews that I've conducted to get impressions of segregation during the 1950s and what some of these performers had to go through just to play their music in certain places in this country. We need to always remember it wasn't that long ago that people were treated this way. And in many cases, certain segments of our population are still treated this way. Thank you, Herbie. And thank you, cats and kittens, for listening to The Juke in the Back. I'm Matt the Cat. Now, baby, I want to close down the show with the Cleftones' return to the R&B Top 10. 1961. They're one of the only groups solidly rooted in the 1950s that would have a big comeback in the early 1960s, kind of reinventing their sound. And we're going to hear Herbie Cox talk about that reinvention in just a moment. We lost Herbie Cox on December 7th, 2019, at the age of 80. And we're going to let Herbie have the final word. Have a great week, everybody. I'll catch you on the flip side next time. Bye-bye.
As the 60s came around,
yeah,
you got a female singer in the group.
Yes, we did.
Now,
what's the story behind
that?
The story behind that is that we had a couple of mild hits and songs like Why Do You Do Me Like You Do did well in 58, 59. But basically, we were not sort of what was happening then. And we decided to try to give ourselves a shot in the arm and a new sound, specifically since Buzzy had left. Berman Patterson was going in the military about that time. So we took Gene Pearson from the Rivoliers. That's the guy who wrote 1,000 Stars.
Love that song.
Yeah, he wrote that song when he was with the Rivoliers. And he lived in our neighborhood. He joined us after he returned from the military. And he suggested that we get a female singer since all the girls' groups were sort of happening then. He said that might help us. And we took a young lady in that Gene knew, Patricia Spann, and she did help us because she gave us a complete new angle on our singing. She's a great lead singer. And did some of the leads. None of them became big hits, but many.
Let It Please Be You.
Yes, yes.
That's a good one.
That's right. Heavenly Father, she also did a nice job on. But she helped us with the harmonies and a whole different thing. And one of the people at the record company said, fellas, if you have, because we had, up to that time, we had written almost all of our songs. They said, why don't you do some other songs? And we said, well, which ones? And I remember this to this day, a gentleman at the record company, Joe Kulski, said, look, there's no excuse for not having good songs. He said, anything else can be wrong, but you should never be doing a bad song. He said, take some standards. And with that, we said, like what? He said, like this, Heart and Soul, I fell in love with you. We said, oh, that's that corny piano song. Never.
Heart and soul, I fell in love with you. Heart and soul, the way.
But, Charlie was experimenting with the guitar at that time. We had some little different Latin rhythms, and we were both fans of Sam Cooke, and we were watching some of the things that Sam was doing, and that's what inspired us to do Heart and Soul in the way that we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked, and we quickly tried sort of the same thing with I Love You for Sentimental Reasons.
Right.
And that made the charts, too, in a more limited way.
Yeah.
Yes, and I lost control and tumbled overboard gladly.
Yeah.
That magic night, a wee kiss,
that we kiss,
a wee kiss,
that we kiss,
a wee kiss,
that we kiss,
a wee kiss,
that we kiss.
There in the moon mist, oh, but your lips were thrilling, much too thrilling. Never before were mine so
strangely.
What embrace can do. Come on and look at me. You've got me loving you madly.
Yeah.
That little kiss that you stole.
You stole.
You stole.
You stole.
Well, we've run out of whiskey and the women have all gone home. Thanks for dropping by. Feel free to let Matt the Cat know if you dug the show. Email him at mattthecat@mattthecat.com. Juke in the Back is recorded at Rosie's Juke Joint, located at the Stepping Stone Inn in Salem, Massachusetts. For more information, please visit jukeintheback.org. I'm Miss Rosie. See you next time on the Juke in the Back.